Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. In so many ways, we have been binging on all the wrong things and dying of hunger for the things that really matter. We as a society need to stop looking outward for happiness and begin to look inward. I've learned a long time ago that material things won't make me happy. Let me ask you a question. Has chasing and sacrificing your precious time and energy trying to obtain stuff made you truly happy? If you die tomorrow, does any of that material stuff matter at all? Well, today's guest is going to help us figure this out and answer some deep questions about the material world and what we really are looking for in this life. It is happiness, is to be happy, to be joyful, to love others. Those are the important things, not the newest iPhone, not the newest TV or the newest car or biggest giant house. That kind of stuff really doesn't matter. Now, today's guest is Matt Delavella, and he directed an amazing documentary called Minimalism, a documentary about important things. He has also built a massive fan base of 3.15 million followers on YouTube interested in the concept of minimalism. Now, the actual definition of minimalism is about living with less. This includes less financial burdens, such as debt and unnecessary expenses. For many minimalists, the philosophy is about getting rid of excess stuff and living life based on experiences rather than worldly possessions. Matt and I discuss the power of decluttering your life, using minimalism to help you focus on the important stuff, and how the material things we own eventually end up owning us. Beware that this conversation might change the way you look at life. Let's dive in.
Alex, thanks for having me, dude. Excited to connect with you again, man. It's been a little while.
Yeah, man. It's been a minute. I mean, when you had me on your podcast in 2017,
very early on in the year.
Right, exactly. I came to your house, and we recorded. It's, by the way, still one of the best interviews I've had, and I've abused that video everywhere, as you've noticed. I love that interview. It was great. It was a great interview, and you had just literally gotten off the boat from New York, like fresh off the boat.
Yeah, that was a fresh start for my now wife and I. We, you know, it was mostly a personal decision. It wasn't let's move out to LA to be closer to the film industry. I had an established freelance career at that time, and I was moving into doing more original content. For us, it was more so my wife's from Sydney, Australia. So to be able to visit family, you know, it's a 23-hour flight from New York is kind of rough. So we got the direct flight from LA, and it's a lot easier now to see family. But that said, it's certainly been great just to be in LA. There's so many creative people that I've gotten the chance to connect with. Mm-hmm. So it definitely rivals New York in terms of the creative energy for sure.
Yeah, I just literally got back from New York. I was visiting there on vacation, and it is such a different energy, man. Oh my God. Yeah. It's so – I was right in the middle of Midtown. Oh God, I was staying in Midtown for like 4 or 5 days. I was just like,
it'll get to you after a little while for sure.
It just like, you know, you walk out at like 7 a.m. to go to Gregory's to pick up some coffee, and all of a sudden you're just like, boom, like, is it noon? Is like, what is going on? There is so much action going on. Like the city does not sleep, while LA is just chilled, much more
right.
Chilled.
Well, we lived in West Hollywood, so it was a little bit busier, but definitely not close to New York. And then recently, 3 months ago, we moved to closer to the beach. So now we're really living the LA life, and it's very chill. I mean, there's not as much chaos. So for us, we're finding some stillness and quiet here, which has been great.
And I'm in the valley, so you know we're nice and quiet over here as well.
For sure, I love it. Yeah,
nice. Now, where I first saw you was the documentary Minimalism. because I was just scanning through Netflix. I was like, ooh, minimalism. I want to be a minimalist. Yes, I have too much crap in my life. I right. need to watch this documentary. And I watched it and I loved the documentary. And that's when you're – I think – I forgot who connected us. It was a mutual friend who connected –
Yeah, Matt Webb.
Matt Webb, yes. Yes, Matt. Matt connected us. And he's like, hey, do you know the guys who made Minimal? I'm like, I don't. I would love to be on his podcast. I think that would be awesome to talk minimalism.
That was very kind of you to come on the show because I had probably 50 downloads an episode at the time. And it was definitely one of my favorite episodes early on that, you know, you brought it. You have so much experience both in like the industry and also in the independent stuff. So I learned a lot and you helped me create a bunch of really great little teasers that we got to share around on Instagram, which is always helpful.
Dude, it was my absolute pleasure. And now the foot is on the other shoe, as they say, because you now have a massive audience, which we will talk about later. But let's get back into minimalism. So tell me about minimalism. How did it come about? And first of all, what is the definition of minimalism by itself? And then we'll get into the movie.
Yeah, so minimalism is a lifestyle that helps us figure out what's most important in life. It often starts with the things, the stuff that you know, of course, most American homes have a lot of clutter. We've got attics and basements and sheds filled with stuff. I certainly know
storage companies like that.
Massive. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, right?
It's like ridiculous.
And our houses are what, like 30, 50 times bigger than they were in the 40s. And now we have storage, so much stuff that we need to throw them in storage lockers. So I think minimalism addressed that problem in a big way for a lot of people. And it started with decluttering and like, let's just clear out the stuff that we don't value, don't care about, don't look at, don't notice anymore, and just curate a set of things that we really love and we really value and we want to take care of and focus on. But then, of course, by getting rid of this stuff, it also allows us much more time to focus on the important things, what we want to get out of life, asking some deeper questions about where we want to take our lives, what do we want to do, who are the people that we want to spend our time with. So I think that was probably the biggest thing for me when it came to minimalism. And it was just after I graduated college that I found out about it for myself. Of course, it's not a new idea, but there's this resurgence of the idea, many more people talking about it now. And minimalism helped me to just redefine what my idea of success was, both as a filmmaker, as a creative, you know, monetarily. I just thought I had to get to a certain place in order to be happy. I needed to have all the stuff. Right. I need to have a nice car. I need to have a really nice house. And all these things, the tech gadgets that I thought I needed to be successful and to feel successful. And then I just realized that after discovering it, that I had enough to be content. I had enough to be happy with where my life was at. Sure, I was still ambitious and I still wanted to make films and I wanted to be driven creatively. And I still had these things that I wanted to accomplish in my life, but I wasn't letting that get in the way of my happiness. I was able to take a step back and actually enjoy the journey and the process. And not to say that it was a light bulb flash instant, everything was perfect and I was content from that moment on, because life gets in the way. We certainly have our struggles and that's part of life. But it's given me greater awareness and acceptance for the life I'm living and a much more appreciation for what I have and what I had.
And then you decided to make a whole documentary about it.
Yeah, so that came about. I had been freelancing for probably 7 or 8 years, and I had been making pretty good money, paying down my student loans, which I had over $98,000.
Oh, my God, dude. Can we just stop for a second? Can we just talk about student debt, dude?
Please. It's a problem.
It's for filmmakers specifically. And I know a lot of people. I'm going to be actually speaking to someone in the future, or am I in the past, depending on when this gets released, that was able to pay off their entire $40,000 or $50,000 student debt in 11 months, and they tell you exactly how they did it. And I'm like, yes, we need to talk about it. I think it's, if anyone's listening to this and you want to be a filmmaker, would you advise putting $98,000 in debt to become a filmmaker?
No, and the world has changed a lot since that time. Now there's a lot more opportunities to create on your own. So what I would probably suggest is there are so many alternatives, especially for the first 2 years of college. So whether you're taking community classes, online college, whatever it is, I could have significantly reduced the amount of debt and given myself some time to breathe, to find my path. But like, dude, most of the stuff I learned in terms of filmmaking wasn't from sitting down in a class. It was from, and by the way, I was a broadcast telecommunications major, so it was more so TV, but it was me grabbing a camera, like as cheap as it was and as bad as the quality was at the time, and just running out, filming, doing a bunch of stuff, editing on my laptop, and just making films. That's how I got really good. And that's how I started to see myself, distance myself from those that were in my class. There were a lot of people in my class that were just waiting for the syllabus and for the instructor to tell them how to be a filmmaker, how to make a great video. And I was just running out, just experimenting, trying different things because I really loved it. Like you couldn't force me not to do it. So I think that's one of the things that you have to learn is that like the piece of paper nowadays, especially when it comes to creativity and filmmaking, it's not going to be as necessary as you think. Like if I'm going to hire somebody, I'm looking at their work and I'm getting to know them and understanding if they're going to mesh well with myself and the people I work with. But at the end of the day, like I don't need that piece of paper to legitimize your value.
Without question. I even heard that now Google is taking kids right out of high school. They won't even look at people with college degrees because they're just like, no, we'd rather take someone clean and train them exactly how we want them. Yeah. And if they have the skills, that's it. It's, I've always told people like, look, if you don't have to worry about money, sure, go to film school. It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. It's a sure. nice four yeah. years. You'll meet some people. It'll be great. But if not, man, I mean, I walked out with about $18,000 to $20,000 in debt and I was able to pay that off luckily within a few years after I got out. But $98,000, that's like obscene amount of money, you know?
Yeah. And that's around the time when I discovered minimalism and, you know, I was living in my parents' basement just after college, had $98,000 in debt. The smartest thing I could think of, which was to buy a brand new car. So now I'm like $118,000 in debt. I'm just buried. And I feel like a failure. I'm like, what is going on? Like, what have I done with my life? All my friends were going out and getting their starting jobs and starting salaries. Right. And then minimalism helped me to take a step back and kind of redefine that idea of success like we talked about. And also it gave me a drive, a deep drive to want to be debt free, to have that freedom of being able to move where I wanted to, take the jobs that I wanted to. You know, a lot of times it's very easy to just focus on filmmaking or that creative pursuit that you have when our lives should be taken into account and how flexible we are, how little debt we have. That determines what jobs we can take in the future and really our career path in general. So like it all matters. So for me, like paying off my debt, it took me about 4.5 years, which was just...
That's impressive. Basically
every dollar I made. And as I grew my business did pretty well. I grew my business doing I did 50, 60 weddings probably over the years, bar mitzvah videos, anything I could get my hands on, started working with tech companies and I would just pile up money, but I didn't see it as my money. I never did. I was like, I'm in debt. This money isn't mine. It belongs to the bank. And that separation for me allowed me to not get attached to the money and not feel like, oh my God, like I'm losing something. Because all I saw was I was gaining freedom by paying off my debt.
Oh, it's a great way to look at it. Great way to look at it. I just wanted to talk about that because it's something that does not talk. It's a complete. It's a crisis, man. It's a crisis because I anytime I hear a filmmaker tell me like, oh yeah, I got $100,000 of debt and I just got out, and I'm like, it hurts me because I know as well as you do, it will take years for them to pay that back if they're good. Like it took you 4 years and you were hustling to try to get it off. You were like focused on it. But if you don't, it could take decades. It's like literally walking out with a mortgage of a house that you never get to touch.
And you're going to end up paying way more. So if you're the person that's like, forget about it. It's not even a big problem. Like
interest only
minimum.
You're
going to end up. Yeah. You're going to end up paying like an addition. Like if you have $100,000 in debt, you might end up paying 150, 175 in 20 to 30 years total. So, I mean, it's the smartest thing you could do financially is to wipe out your debt and have a clean record.
It's all about ROI, man. What's the return on the investment? Is it worth it or not? All right. So back to your documentary. So you got into minimalism and then you put this documentary together. How did it come about?
So I was working freelance. I had set like a little corny bucket list that had about 20 items on it, from like fall in love with somebody who doesn't speak English and like a bunch of silly cliches.
That's awesome.
But then at the top of the list was make a documentary about something I care about. And minimalism was something that had already impacted my life. So that was kind of in the back of my mind. And then I happened to meet these guys, Josh and Ryan, who run a website called The Minimalists. They've got an amazing podcast under the same name. And I basically offered to help them out. Like, they were coming to New York. They needed somebody to shoot a video for them. So I said, hey, your guys' work has impacted me greatly, and I would love to somehow give back, help out, shoot a video for you. Like, whatever you'd be willing to charge me, I'd be happy to take it. And that, like, again, that's from this fact that I was doing pretty well financially, so I wasn't struggling. I just wanted to work on projects I was passionate about. So a lot of times it's like, if you're in that position cornered against the wall and you need to make money, you may not be able to do something like that because maybe they wouldn't be willing to pay you your rate. But anyway, we ended up working together. The videos we put together ended up being, they really enjoyed them. I thought it turned out great. And we just built a relationship and got to know each other. And then probably 3 months later, Josh gave me a call. And he's like, hey, like, what do you think about making a documentary about minimalism? And his initial idea was to just do a tour documentary. So pretty basic, like just follow us around on tour and then it'll just be about us, you know, talking about our book and talking about minimalism. And maybe we can make this like 45-minute piece that we could release to our audience. That was kind of the gist of it. But I was thinking a little bit bigger picture. And I was like, well, you know, this is a massive, or at least in my eyes, was a massive movement. It was pretty small at the time, but there was still like, you know, tens of thousands of people that were focused and practicing this thing called minimalism. There were blogs that were getting just as many views and hits. So I knew it was an idea that was resonating. And I was like, there's really something here. If we interview all these people who are minimalists, if we maybe find some experts to talk to help us talk about consumerism, our culture, the American dream, maybe we can understand how we got here. So it started with the tour, like, let's just go out on tour. Let's just film you guys as you continue to spread and talk about this message of minimalism. And then let's interview people along the way and see what we can put together. There was some planning in the beginning, but like Mike Tyson says, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the jaw and the face. And that certainly happened with me. I had this beautiful vision of how these scenes would be laid out, how every interview would be shot in the same exact way. And then when you get there and it's just you, you do the best you can with each situation, each environment you're put into. Right. And so we filmed a ton and then took a step back and said, okay, like, what do we have here? We started editing together, rough cut 1, 2, 3, filming more footage. It was probably a process of 2 to 3 years. From the very conception of the idea to the time we finally had our like theatrical release and debut, and we ended up promoting the thing and releasing it online. But it definitely, like, at least in how it was received, was well beyond all of our expectations, because it was just me shooting and editing 95% of it. I had some people and friends help out along the way, and I had a friend color grade it for cheap. I had somebody else that I found, Peter Duff. He did the sound mix for cheap. And so we were able to really make it work. But we didn't think it was going to be like a hit. We didn't think anybody was going to really watch it, because a lot of documentaries go to Netflix to die. They can, at least. You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of documentaries, probably thousands of documentaries on there. So we didn't have expectations that it was going to do well. We just wanted to hopefully make our money back, but really make a film that we cared about and could help some people.
But the thing that I find fascinating, and I always kind of preach this as well, is this: you guys, at least you were thinking about this more than the boys were, that there was a niche audience here. There was a mm-hmm. niche audience that was growing. It was is about the hockey stick up as far as the trajectory of the minimalist, because now minimalism it's a lot more mainstream than it was.
Yeah.
When you guys were starting.
Totally. You're always going to have uncertainty, I think. Like, mm-hmm. you're never going to be like, yo, totally. Like, there's definitely going to be people who buy this film. No. But we had a great – I mean, we probably ended up spending around $50,000 on the film totally, maybe 70. You know, that's like after color, sound. We had a original music score, which probably mm-hmm. cost the most. which helped us in terms of like, then we didn't have to deal with licensing, because licensing can be like really tough. All the legal stuff is challenging to navigate. But yeah, we didn't have any expectations, but we did know that, hey, they have a decent sized audience. I don't know how many people, like whether it was 50 or 100,000 people a month that went to their blog, but I was like, that's enough, I think, to make our money back. Mm-hmm. And
what year was that, by the way? What year was that?
2016 is when we released it. So at the end of 2016. So it did very well. And it was then I think it was at that point that we reinitiated conversations with Netflix. Be like, hey, it did really well. Like a lot of people are connecting with this film. And then we were able to gather connected with this third party company, Kino Lorber, who's a distributor, who finally got us onto Netflix. And again, we weren't sure how it was going to do, if it was going to even perform well or people were going to see it. But then I think it was just the right timing, the right idea, and we executed on it well enough that it ended up trending, and it was certainly seen by way more people than we thought.
That's awesome, man. Now, before we get into your YouTube, man, you had a freelance business. I'm assuming you're not doing as much freelance anymore?
I'm not doing any freelance anymore, and it was hard to turn away from because I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I love doing client work, especially the further I got along into it, because the more selective you can be and the more I was just working with clients I love. As I mentioned, I did weddings and bar mitzvahs and local TV commercials, like anything I could get my hands on to build my skills and expertise. And then as that evolved, I started working with more startups and tech companies. I worked with a company, Envision, a lot, which they're an amazing prototyping design tool. They ended up funding a full feature-length documentary called Design Disruptors,
mm-hmm.
which was where we went and we interviewed with Airbnb and Twitter and Facebook and at Google, the self-driving car division at Google. So like, talk about how they design experiences today for consumers and people that use technology, which is basically everybody. And so it was like, fun. It was exciting. And I was working on really creative projects, and they all had pretty good budgets. So, and I was making good money, but then I released Minimalism and I was like, I like this better. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and it's more challenging and it's going to be way more risky if I drop all client work and go full in on creating original content. And like, it truly was a risk. Like, I'm making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to making $0 a year. And I didn't make a dime it was like a year and a half pursuing YouTube. But that transition was one that I knew I had to make, because as much as I love the freelance stuff, as much as I was connected and tied to it, I knew that there was a bigger challenge for me to face, and I would regret it if I didn't do it.
Yeah. And same goes for me. I was, you know, I had my thriving post-production business I've had for 20 years. And within the last year and a half, I stopped. I just said, I turned down work now, because now I'm doing full-time indie film hustle and filmtrepreneur and all the things that I do with it. And it's
your time, dude. Like, you can't do it all. As much as you would love to have all the time to work. And I know you, dude, you work harder than anybody I know. So I know just how much you probably push yourself to do both at the same time.
It's just too much, man.
It's a tipping point. You gotta put your family first, and you need to make sure that you're not sacrificing too much.
And very much like you, like, you just start figuring out what makes you happy and what is your new definition of success and happiness. And that took me years to figure out. I mean, you're a bit younger than I am, but we've both figured it out. I wish I would have figured it out at your age, but I figured it out at my age. And I said, you know what? I like doing this. I like waking up in the morning, creating content, being of service to my community, and also go out and get to make my own films, write books, do other things. And it's just so much more satisfying as a human being to do all that, and as a creative to do all that, than it is just to do client work and deal with the politics and deal with the, I have to chase money, or I have to go do this, and all this other stuff.
It's a dream, dude. I mean, that's what stand-up comedians, their goal, for at least most of them, there's obviously a handful of people who just want to be famous, just like people who get into YouTube. Right. But like, the dream is to make a living doing what you love, to make a living making films or doing stand-up comedy, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And making a living is paying the bills, period. If you can get to that point, like, I think that's what most people should be striving for. And you fall into the trap of always wanting more and more. And that's where I think you could potentially, you're going to hurt your happiness, because if you're constantly chasing happiness or chasing this success or whatever it is, that presupposes that you don't have it now and you likely never will.
Right.
So by being content in the moment and like just being grateful for the fact that we can do this for a living, I think is that's everything.
Yeah, because most filmmakers, I know I did, get caught up in the whole, I need to get into the studio system. I need to make big, huge movies. I need to be a millionaire. I need to live in the Hollywood Hills and live that lifestyle. And that's the definition, of being a successful filmmaker, where that is a definition for some people, but it's okay to make a living being a filmmaker or doing things in the film industry that is not, shooting Avengers or Avatar. It's like it's okay. And how many directors get to do that? Literally, like how many studio directors are there? Literally, like, I don't know, a few hundred, that like maybe 1,000 guys in the hit, like we're talking about 50, 60 year generation here of filmmakers, like from Scorsese all the way to Nolan and Fincher. Like there's not a lot of dudes that get $100-200 million check. It's just,
I don't know each of these people personally, but I certainly know that a lot of these top directors have a lot of stress in their lives. And to be at the top is not something that we all should admire, because, if you polled the 1,000 people who potentially do these big budget films and you ask them all how happy they are and how content they are, like I would be surprised if more than 50% of them were like thrilled with their life or their life was in balance. There's a lot of things that we don't see from the outside. And I think if you're constantly trying to, and I could be wrong, but I think if we're constantly trying to have these extrinsic rewards and these external measures of success, fame, wealth, instead of looking internally about, are we content? Are we happy with what we have? Are we filled with our jobs and our family? Then we're going to be making a big mistake, because there's always more stuff. You can always have more crap, or you can always have a bigger film and, you have a hit film, but what happens if the next film flops and like nobody watches it and then your career is over? If you didn't do those internal and ask those internal questions first, then it's going to be a pretty big fall from the top.
Yeah, no question. And imagine the pressure, man. Like you and I have done production. So like, imagine you have, $250,000 on your head as a director producer, or $1 million on your head as a director producer. That's stressful. It's stressful. You have to make your day. You got to deal with the talent that's having an issue because, they had a breakup with their boyfriend or girlfriend. And now they're slowing down production. So now you can't get your day. And then the producer's going to be yelling at you. And there's all these other things. And let's not even talk about if it's a success or not. That's just making the damn thing, let alone trying to be as successful. And that's at $1 million level. Can you imagine at a 50, 100, $200 million level, there is a few human beings on the planet that really have that capability. Will I take the meeting from Marvel? Absolutely. I will take that meeting. I think you would take the meeting. I mean, right? You're like, let's go.
100%. You take the meeting.
You take the meeting, like you take the meeting. But like I'm sure the Duplass brothers, right? They took that meeting with Marvel and they said no, because they're like, it's not really what we want to do. And that's a really strong conviction of who they are and what makes them happy. They have that definition very clear, where everybody else in Hollywood would kill for that job.
100%. The ability to say no, I think, is a muscle that not enough people work at. Mm-hmm. And Greg McKeown, who wrote the book Essentialism, talks about the myth of success, how you get to the point where you work your whole life to be successful, you finally get it, and then all of a sudden you get all these amazing opportunities, all these other opportunities to say yes to things. So people start taking it, and like startups and tech companies fall into this trap. They start trying to do everything they possibly can because now they have the resources and the team to try to go after it. But then they lose sight of what got them success in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you have to develop that muscle, the ability to say no. And especially if you're looking for happiness and contentment, if all you're looking for is financial reward and gain, you'll say yes to a bunch of other things. And then, it could fall in your face and it could end up not working out well for you if you say yes to too much.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
All right, so let's get into YouTube, brother, because when I met you, you were doing a podcast, and you were kind of playing around in YouTube, but you weren't really deep in yet. I mean, were you making videos at that point?
I think that's a good way to look at it. I was basically following the Joe Rogan method, which is, he's got a YouTube channel and he's got his main podcast. And what you see with Joe Rogan is a lot of excerpts from that podcast. So you record this for him, a 3-hour interview, but I might do an hour, two tops, and then I can cut it up into all these short clips and then I can post it on my YouTube channel. Yeah.
Sure.
So that was like my main.
But you were focusing on building a YouTube. You're like, I'm going to do something in YouTube. It wasn't like a.
The podcast was my main form of content, especially for the first year as I started to make original content. I thought the podcast was the thing that was going to be my bread and butter and be my financial income as well as my creative pursuit. But then. Mm-hmm. Basically, I did that for a very long time and I just didn't get any views. And I knew that I was giving myself like 2 to 3 years and I had a runway from my freelance career that I was able to, just dedicate myself at least for a year, maybe 2 years. And also having a wife that supported me financially helped out a whole lot.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Shout out to the wives and the husbands out there that are holding things down.
Yes.
Because that definitely, it's more so peace of mind and like made me feel comfortable in doing it, and having her support allowed me to pursue it. But the podcast, it grew a little bit. I was getting a few thousand downloads a month, but it wasn't at the point where it was financially viable for me. So I was like, all right, what can I do now to like just switch things up? And then I just, started watching more YouTube videos and just was paying attention to what other people were doing, and then said, oh, you know what? Why don't I do like a minimalist apartment tour? There was a couple of videos I did early on. One was just like traveling simply, like how
I remember that
travel
one.
While being simple. And it was like more, it was really voiceover as well as just vacation footage of a recent trip that I had taken to Hawaii, I believe. And then the next video I did was my minimalist apartment. And then that one was the first video I made that really took off. So it wasn't just like a cliche like tour. Like, hey guys, it wasn't like MTV Cribs. Welcome to my apartment. This is my stuff.
MTV Cribs. You've dated yourself, sir.
Yes, I certainly have. And so in that video, it was like I tried to make it really cinematic. I tried to use all this expertise that I had created over the years to make something that was interesting and informative and funny and had my personality in it. So I basically just chopped together this video, put it on YouTube, and then within a week, I think it got 20,000 views, which was like
the algorithm just picked it up.
The algorithm picked it up because I didn't have an audience and I had maybe 3,000 subscribers. So like, yeah, maybe it would have gotten 400 views, but then it just took off in a way that I hadn't seen with any other video. And then that moment changed everything. And then I'm like, oh, okay, now I get it. I'm starting to like see the Matrix code. That dates me too a little bit too, probably. But I'm starting to like see in between the lines. And I'm like, all right, this is the kind of content I should be making. It should be thoughtful. I should take my time to create it. And I shouldn't feel like I need to release 3 videos every week. So I just started out by doing 1 video a week, whether it was on minimalism, simple living, focusing on things that I was interested in talking about. Mostly talking about myself and experiences that I had had, why I became a minimalist, how to be in a relationship with somebody who isn't a minimalist.
Yeah, and then that was a good one.
That was certainly, I think a lot of people resonate with that because living with somebody who has a different lifestyle certainly is not the easiest thing to navigate for people. But for us, we've made a channel. Like I released my minimalist apartment that started to grow. Mm-hmm. And that's when my audience and my YouTube channel started to take off. Yeah.
So you were still doing your podcast at that time. But you started seeing that this other content was taking off more and more. What have you learned about building an audience? Because you've built, well, first of all, there was a moment because you were doing those videos and I was watching you, cause I was a subscriber of yours. So I was watching what you were doing. And then there was a moment that there was an explosion. Like there was an all of a sudden I looked over and you're like, he's got 100,000 followers. Like how did that happen? He's got 200,000 followers. Like how did that happen? Like there was something that happened. What was that thing that happened that like just exploded your channel?
Yeah, that was a really exciting time, especially looking back on it and seeing, it's almost like watching it from another perspective. Like, it wasn't happening to me, it was happening to somebody else. I basically had put out that one video, My Minimalist Apartment, and I started to make similar videos and they started to do pretty well. So I had a streak of about a month where my channel was naturally growing. So maybe I like just natively through the algorithm, through people watching and subscribing, I think I grew to around 15,000 subscribers or so. And then I was featured as a creator on the rise. So YouTube picked me up in the algorithm. They saw that my channel was doing really well and growing quickly. And then when they put me on that homepage thing and featured me as a creator on the rise, which is like an amazing experience and surreal. You're like, wait a minute, they saw it. I guess they saw it. YouTube saw it. And then they picked me. They probably have some way of sorting and figuring out like, okay, these channels are growing quickly. Let's check to make sure they're kosher. And like, they actually, it would fit with putting them on the homepage of the trending. So if you went to youtube.com/trending, there's a whole category there. I made it there. And then probably in a day, I got like 15,000 subscribers, right? So it doubled in a day. And then each day after that, it was still like picking up. And then I probably in the course of that few months, like you said, got to about 100,000 subscribers. So it happened very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And that was a big moment. And that's like when a huge growth started. And then like you have now a foundation to be able to build upon, which was exciting and knowing and like a little bit nerve wracking too, right? Because you're like, I'm uploading videos and now people are watching. It was easy when nobody cared and like I wasn't expecting anything, but now I expect a lot of people to watch it. And so that was certainly a learning lesson and something that I had to grow into. And then there was actually another moment last October, so not even that long ago, in the past year, that my I did four videos. I think I like had four or five videos go viral, like hit over 1 million views back to back to back. And one of them was A Day in the Life of a Minimalist, mm-hmm. which currently has, it's my most viewed video. It has over 11 million views. And like, so that all was crazy. And I think I got 200,000 subscribers in a month, just from that month alone. And then from there, like that's how it's been kind of snowballed into what it is today. But, you know, it's awesome. It's great. Originally my goal was to get 15,000 subscribers. I thought if I could get 15,000, I'm pretty sure I can make a living doing this. So everything else has been cake on top of it. It's been very cool to be a part of, and I've just been blown away by how nice people have been in the YouTube comments, that there's like really a community there of people who are working on themselves and trying to learn, and they're not being critical or judgmental. Of course, yeah, I got a few little negative Nancys in the comment section every once in a while, but for the most part, everybody's just been super awesome. And it's just been, it's been an amazing thing to be a part of, and certainly something I'm proud of.
And, but the big tip there, I think, and people listening, thinking about trying to do something like this, is that you were hustling out content for a while before anything happened. So by the time that YouTube showed up, it wasn't that you had two videos up there. You had a lot of content up there. And they said, oh, wait a minute, there is a lot of content. So when people started to show up, they subscribed not off of one video, but they described because you had a portfolio or a library of videos already created, but you weren't getting any money for those and you weren't getting any kind of views for those, but you just kept grinding until something popped.
Yeah, and it was 10 years too to that point, right, of doing freelance and working on films. And again, like not making any money. Like I didn't make money in the beginning when I first started freelancing, and that's not why I made videos to begin with. And I wasn't making money early on in YouTube, not why I did it. And you couldn't stop me. You couldn't stop me from making videos. Like I loved it. Like, right. You know what I mean? That would be torture to me. If somebody were to take away all my cameras and say that I can't make films anymore, it would be a struggle for me to figure out something else to do with my life. Mm-hmm. So I was going to do that no matter what, whether, you know, of course there was always the potential that it wasn't going to work out. And I think that's something that everybody needs to come to terms with. It may not, and it's certainly not going to turn out to be the life you'd imagined, or it's not going to happen the way you might expect it to happen, but you have to continually focus on what you love. So for me, like if I didn't make it as a YouTuber, I would have just done freelance again. And it wouldn't have felt like a failure. I would have been so proud that I tried, that I actually made the attempt. And then if it didn't work in 3-4 years, whatever time we decided, hey, like, you know, we need to pay for the wedding, or we need to, Natalie, we might get a house, or we have kids and we have even more bills that we need to take care of. I had that opportunity to go after it. And if it didn't work, that'd be fine. I'll do freelance and I'll still make videos. Maybe I'll take another stab at it again in the future. But, you know, you always have options. And I still always in the back of my mind, in the back pocket, is like wedding films. I'm like, if everything falls apart and nobody ever watches a YouTube video of mine again, and I cannot get build a freelance career again, I'll just start making I'll make wedding films, and I would be totally fine to do that. And like, it's good money, and I could still make videos. So that to me, like, just it's almost like just a security wall for me that I just know, like, I'm always going to be doing this no matter what, unless I go blind or something happens to me. Knock on wood, but I think unless anything like that happens, I'm still going to continue to make videos. So.
What I also find fascinating about your meteoric rise, if you will, in the YouTube space is that money was not the main focus of what you were doing. I mean, it was to a certain, you have to make money to survive, but you did not turn on advertising. Your model is very different than others. So can you talk a little bit about the business aspect of your YouTube channel?
Yeah. So for the first, a year and a half, 2 years, I did not turn on monetization. Oof. I did not do any sponsorships. And like, at least $500,000.
Yeah.
I gave up. But yeah. At least. Not a million.
Yeah. I'm thinking about it myself. I'm like, why? But I'd love to see. That's why we're asking.
Sure. Well, in the beginning, it didn't matter because I wasn't, I didn't have any views in the beginning. So I had no incentive to turn it on. And I was more interested in making something popular, interesting, valuable than I was about making money off of it, because even when I just started to gain that traction in the beginning, I was like, I would trade a view for a dollar. I'm not that I would buy views, but basically when you have advertising, you're going to lose a certain amount of people that are going to be clicking on the ads. That's what the advertisers pay for. So I was like, forget it. Like, let me just actually focus on views and building an audience and building a community first. And then I'll figure out the money down the road. I did start Patreon late last year, maybe around October or so, maybe over the summer. And that was my main way to, raise money to do what I do. I create additional videos and podcasts and all that stuff. And then I was able to make good money doing that. And then just recently I decided to finally turn on monetization and sponsorships to do a 6-month trial to see does that hurt views? How do I feel about that? Am I feeling good about the partnerships I'm making and the companies that I'm working with? Do I feel like it just distracts and takes away from the video too much? And then can I use that money to invest back in my videos and make even better videos, maybe travel more and do more films outside of my apartment and outside of Los Angeles? And then invest more into maybe feature-length documentaries. Maybe I can produce whether it's a YouTube original or another Netflix film. There's a lot of awesome things that you can do with money. And yes. I don't need to buy a lot of stuff. Like, I've got all this. I literally have all this stuff I need besides like camera gear and film gear, which is like, it's always an investment. Every few years, you need to continually make sure you have your cameras up to the right standards. And because we love it and we want to make better films. But so that's where I'm investing like all the money I make. Like, obviously, you got the 401k, we got the wedding fund, we've got a fund to potentially buy a house in the future. But for right now, it's just like, I'm just trying to make the best films I can, and money certainly helps.
That's awesome. Now, I do want to talk quick about one of your videos because it's something that's dear to my heart. You took a cold shower for 30 days.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, that was fun. It kind of sucked.
I've been taking a cold shower now for 4 months now, 5 months.
Wow. I
love it. I love it. I actually when it's when the hot water accidentally gets turned on or something like that, I freak out. I don't like it. I don't like the hot water.
Yeah.
I don't like hot water anymore.
It was a surreal experience, like taking a hot shower after that 30 days. But the cold showers wakes you up like nothing else. Like, no cup of coffee ever could.
Yes.
And it's just refreshing too. And now sometimes I don't take cold showers right now, like not religiously, but I will like end on a cold shower. I love doing cold plunges. Like, I love jumping into the ocean. Like, to me, nothing feels better than just like freezing cold water. I don't know what it is about it, but it definitely like it changes your state in an instant. So if you're like anxious or nervous or whatever, if you hop into a cold shower,
it's gone.
Like, you cannot think about anything else but like the pain you're experiencing. But it's like a good pain, right?
But like the thing is this, and I've told people about it. I started doing it because of the Hof method, the Iceman, the guy who does. Wim Hof. Yeah, exactly. And I started studying his stuff. And when I started taking cold showers, I realized that one, every single thing that my mind was telling me to why I should not get into the cold shower is the same excuses it told me about not making a feature film or not doing this, because it was such a outside the box thing. Your brain's there, and I've said this a bunch of times on my podcast, your brain is there. It doesn't care about your happiness. It doesn't give a crap about you getting to your dream or not. It only cares about survival. It only cares about itself. And a cold shower is not in that equation at first, where you have to kind of break through that mental block. And trust me, dude, that first month, man, you know, it was – I started the same way. I start off warm and then slowly cool it off. And now, like, and literally this morning, I went to the shower and I put on like a little, like, it's just a drop of hot water, just a drop, just so it's not absolute freezing. But then as I'm like, it's too hot. And I took it off alcohol all the way.
You adapt to it too. And yeah. I think like you adapt both physically and mentally in terms of how you are prepared to take it. And there's a great book that does talk about this. The Flinch by Julian Smith. And it's about basically, you know, if you're boxing and you're in a fight and somebody snaps their hand at you and snaps a jab at you, if you flinch, you're not going to win that fight. So boxers over time develop this no flinch mentality. So if somebody's going to take a swing at them, they have to always be there locked in. And if they close their eyes, then they're going to get clobbered. And that's what we do in life all the time. We're flinching at these big opportunities, these things that scare us. And instead, we're deciding not to go on that date, not to make that film, not to take that cold shower. And a cold shower is one of those things that there's no harm in it. Unless you have like problems with your heart, you're not going to have any the negative repercussions because of it. It's strictly a personal thing. You feel a little bit uncomfortable. And the more we can embrace those uncomfortable situations, the better we're going to be able to do that throughout the rest of our life.
Yeah, and there's also health benefits too. And I remember I wasn't as sore as I was when I work out because of just – there's a reason why athletes take ice baths.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I love the cold plunge. Like, that would be like a dream of mine.
Cold plunge.
In an ideal world, to have a cold plunge at my house and then maybe a little sauna to be able to do a cycle back and forth.
That's what Tony Robbins has. Tony Robbins has like this dunk, it's like a hole in the ground.
He just 40 degrees or whatever.
He drops in and then he jumps over into the sauna. I'm like, oh,
so good. Yeah.
People I know listening right now are watching. They're like, these guys are crazy.
These guys are nuts.
They're nuts.
I think you have to actually try it. And I would definitely recommend, if you were just getting into it, maybe go to a spa or sauna that has it where you can do the sauna cold plunge. Cause that's like, it's certainly an experience to be had, for sure. It's definitely something you'll remember.
I think it's more of a mental exercise than a physical one, because it's all mental. Like, your body can handle it. Your body will tell you to stop about 20% before your body will snap. So it's just evolution. It's there to protect you, but your body can handle a lot more than your mind thinks it can. And if you can break through that, it does help a lot on our filmmaking journey and our life journey, just being able to break through that uncomfortable state. Cause what do we all always try to do? You know, avoid pain and go towards pleasure. And we're always trying to avoid pain, but the pain's kind of where the good stuff is. That's where the dreams are. Like Joseph Campbell said, the treasure you seek is in the cave that you're afraid to walk into.
I love it. Yeah. That's Ryan Holiday has a book called The Obstacle is the Way.
Yes. Yes.
About stoicism and how in our life we're always trying to avoid obstacles. We think that they're getting in the way of our life when in fact they are life. And the sooner we understand that things will never go according to plan, the quicker we can find contentment in our lives.
Have you delved into Stoicism a lot?
But you know, I just interviewed Ryan Holiday yesterday.
Nice.
Yeah, he's awesome. It was really, really cool to connect with him. It was like surreal too, because I've read all his books and I've been a fan for a while now. But I'm starting to get more into Stoicism. I mean, just the practice of it. A lot of people think it's like a lack of emotion, but that's not it at all. It's just about facing life's challenges mm-hmm. with a level head and not letting yourself like get an overinflated ego, continuing to be thankful for what we have. And I certainly try to put that into practice myself.
And you also interviewed a god in the entrepreneurial space, Gary Vee. What was that like, dude? I have to ask you, man. What was it like talking to Gary, man?
That was cool. So I actually had interviewed Gary once before, like a long time ago when I was doing freelance work. I happened to do an interview with him. So I'd been around him, but like that was before. I mean, he was big then, at least for people who were like in the circle and understood what he was doing and seen one or two of his books he had put out at the time. But obviously to this point now, his company has like exploded and he's almost a household name at this point. He's like very well known, but it was awesome. You know, I over-prepared. I did as much as I could. It was not easy to get the interview.
I
was coordinating with multiple people. I had some connections with friends who worked with Gary Vee, Tyler Babin, one of them, who was a filmmaker. And he's like, just write up an email and I can forward it to him. But he's like, you know, I can't guarantee anything. And then nothing really worked. And then all of a sudden I just sent out a tweet to him one Sunday night and was like, would love to interview you about how we can hustle with more intention, how we can bring more intentionality into our work lives, and how to find happiness. And I think my subscribers might gain some value from that. And then he just responded and just said, in. And I was like, all right, sweet. Like, when is this going to happen? And then it was maybe a couple months later, like we coordinated it. We eventually scheduled an interview. He ended up coming. He was in LA and I happened to have a, 30 minute block with him where I got to talk about intentionality and minimalism. And I prepared the hell out of it. I read every one of his books
going into
it. And I probably, they're so good. I probably overprepared, but like, his books were certainly a good reminder to me. And like, I didn't want to go in there and be like, yo, why do you hustle so hard, Gary? I wanted to understand like this man and how he thinks and works. And when I read his books and I got the full context, I'm like, he's just wants people to be happy. And he thinks that working hard and you got the hat on right now, like hustling and putting in the work is an important aspect to that. And he himself would be miserable if he worked 4 hours a day or if he worked 40 hours a day. Like he would rather work 4 hours a month, a week. Yeah. So for him, it's more about like, I work a lot, but I love what I do. And if I worked any less, I would be miserable. And I think that's certainly an important question to ask ourselves. Like, are we happy with our work? Are we working too hard? Are we not working enough? And where do we find that balance in life?
And I have to ask you, man, how is your quest to get The Rock on the show?
You know what? I still have a photo in my wallet here. Like, I honestly walk around all day with a photo of The Rock in my wallet. And it's been in here. Like, you see it. Like, it's like torn up.
Yeah.
It's like, I have it on the camera up there.
How did you get that? What, did you just like printed it out yourself? That's awesome.
Yeah, like went to like FedEx and I just printed it out. And the guy was looking at me like, this is like some weird shit, but I'm all okay right. with it if you are. And I decided from the beginning, like around a little bit earlier before you came on my podcast, I was like, if I could get one person, like what's the biggest name I could get? Somebody who's got the best ground up story, somebody who's made it, but still continues to put in the work and continues to bust his ass and work really hard. And just seems like a great dude, somebody that I would like want to connect with and have beers with. And I was like, it's got to be The Rock. And I mean, he just continues to get bigger and bigger. And I think it becomes more and more unattainable, but it's fun for me. And like, if I never get The Rock on my podcast, if I never interview him, it's not going to be the end of the world. It's really just about the process, right? And enjoying the attempt. An attempt will be made. So we'll see if we can actually get him on the show.
Yeah, I literally just did an entire episode on a list of all the filmmakers and screenwriters and people I wanted on the show. I'm like, I just said, if anyone out there listening has any connection to any of these people, please reach out to me. And I'm just going to put it out into the universe and see, you know, and I had, you know, Cameron, Spielberg, you know, all the, it's just every big filmmaker, screenwriter, and personality that I wanted to talk to. And we'll see. We'll see. I've had.
You got to go for it. Like,
why not?
I hate it when people are like, oh, are you sure? That person's kind of big. I don't think you're going to be able to get them on the show or your podcast. And I'm like, exactly. It would be amazing if I could get them. And there is a world. There is an order, a sequence of events that can conspire to make it happen. It just depends, like, how much do you want to work for it and how much do you want to put on the line to make it happen.
And how many subscribers do you have now on YouTube as of this recording? Yeah. How many?
1.6.
1.6 million. So at 1.6 million, it's still hard to get The Rock on. But at like 6 or 7 million, will his PR people go, we should probably get him on this show? Like, there's a breaking point, dude. Like, because 1.6 million is no joke.
At least to get, you know, that's the one thing that I have to think about, because I might, you know, who knows, I could get invited to one of these press junkets. And it's like, is that how I want it to go down? Like, would I want it to be like, I don't want to be just one interview amongst 100 in the same setting. No. It needs to be unique. And it, you know, there's certain
Oprah. You want to do Oprah?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It needs to be a story, right? Like, I want to, you know, I mean, now it's not much of a story because my podcast and my YouTube channel has grown. Because, like, in the beginning, it would have been hilarious because it was just a no-name guy. Like, there's a guy. Like, that's the website's Get The Rock On Matt's Podcast. Just some guy named Matt who wants to get The Rock on his podcast. So now, like, some of the air has been taken out of it. But still, it is, you know, it's about that journey from the beginning of a guy that, you know, had nothing, trying to get the biggest superstar on the planet on his podcast. So I'm still going to push for it. I haven't, you know, talked about it too much on the YouTube channel lately. It's been a podcast thing. But you know, once I have some time to delve into it, I want to like put together a plan and make like one video or a series of videos where like that's the only thing I do, and maybe enlist as many friends as I can to try to like stir up and get on his radar.
Other YouTubers,
yeah, exactly. So we'll see if it ends up happening. If it does, it'll be really cool, and I'm sure it'll be a nerve-wracking experience
You know, the funny thing is that if he actually heard this, he would probably do it.
You know what? Like, yeah, I've talked to Brian Bowen Smith, who's a celebrity photographer, and he's worked with The Rock a lot, and he calls him a friend, and he's like, you know, I guarantee, like, it's something that he would want to do. Like, he really is a good dude, and he wants to do everything he possibly can to, like, make people happy and do all the interviews he could possibly do. It's just a matter of like, will the timing work out? You know, I mean, I say no to interviews, right? Like, and then I'm like, The Rock he's The Rock. So everybody asks him to interview him all the time. So the amount of no's that he gives out is exponential to even what I do. So I'm like, I feel bad when I say no to people, because I'm like, I'm sorry. Like right now I'm working on a film. It's just, I can't do an interview right now. And it's like, I'm like, it's just me. Like, I don't see myself. I don't hold myself in high regard.
I agree with you. I get asked things all the time, and I have to say no to. I've learned to say no to them, but I do appreciate you saying yes to this interview, though. I do appreciate.
Of course, man. Absolutely.
I know you're big time now, so I do appreciate it.
No, not at all. Dude. So I mean, you helped me out so much when I got started. So
what is the next thing for you, man? Like, what is in, you know, the next few years, man? Because I don't want to be derogatory, but I'm so proud of you. I don't want to say, you know, I'm proud of, because I saw you literally fresh off the boat with like, hey man, I'm just hustling, you know, this podcast, and I'm trying to get this little YouTube channel off the ground to 1.6 million subscribers, and you kind of blew up, and I see all the work you've put into it, and it's a lot of work, man. You do a lot of work. Yeah. There's no question. But what's the next steps? Like, do you want to do more feature films? Do you want, because now you have an audience. Like, if you decided to make Minimalism 2, which would kind of go against Minimalism, but, Minimalism 2, The Electric Boogaloo, if you decide to go down that road, and you have a built-in audience that way you could easily self-distribute the film, you could, you know, probably finance the film yourself, then there's a lot of filmtrepreneurial things that you could do based on the audience that you've put together. You could create different contexts, you can create online courses on how to become a minimalist. There's so many different things that you can do. What is the next steps for you, man?
Yeah. So first I would say that like I have definitely pushed up to the point of burnout multiple times. And I know this is something that a lot of YouTubers and creators, entrepreneurs deal with. And I think that if you haven't pushed yourself that far, it's a good test. It's good to know like the line and where we should be drawing it. Cole Walliser is the one that told me that. He's like, just push yourself across that line every once in a while, but then come back and then understand, okay, that's probably a little bit too much. I probably don't want to spend that much time working. So now I feel great. I mean, I've had some anxieties in the past and some burnout and all this stuff, but now I feel like I'm at a place in my life where balance is there. I'm dedicating myself to my health and my wellness mm-hmm. and my life, and also creating the films that I want to make, and I'm not sacrificing on quality in any way. Continue to make films is and always will be the goal and what I plan to do. What form that takes, what platform that ends up on, I'm not really sure. We are working with Netflix on another film. And it is like, it's not Minimalism V2, but it's like similar story, Josh and Ryan's story. And we're kind of going into it and telling it in a totally different way. So we are working on that film. I'm doing the YouTube videos. Once that film's complete, yeah, I think it would be really cool to do an original documentary, probably not. I don't know about a series. A series is too overwhelming unless there was funding for it.
Right.
But that said, like, I think it would be fun to do an original project, maybe something like my YouTube videos, maybe like a film on self-help and self-development. I think it'd be really cool and fun. And I think I could basically just make a longer format version of one of my YouTube videos. But other than that, yeah, I mean, you have to continually push yourself, and you got to mm-hmm. do things that you're uncertain of and unknown whether it's going to be work out or not. And that's what I'm most excited about, is just embracing the unknown.
That's awesome, dude, man. Again, I want to congratulate you, brother, on all your success. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy, man. Seriously, I'm happy to see you, that you're doing well, man, and that you're doing good work and you're being of service to your community and to the world at large for people. I mean, the concept of minimalism is so important. I mean, it was because of you I threw away a bunch of shirts that I was looking for 6 months later. But
yeah,
I'm not kidding you. I went through my whole closet and I started dumping stuff, and then I lost 40 pounds. And then I'm like, oh, let me get that Hawaiian shirt on. I'm like, oh, I don't have it anymore. I threw it away. Oh, I've been waiting for years to wear that damn thing.
There are more Hawaiian shirts out there.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way I look at it. I look at it that way. But yep. I've tried to become more minimalist in my life, and it's helped me out a lot. I'm not where you're at. Because I have children and I would love to see your life with children.
Can't wait.
That's going to be,
I can't wait. It's going to change. Things will change for sure.
The minimalist father is going to be that should be the next YouTube channel. The minimalist father.
That's really good. Yeah. When everything falls apart, it might be an oxymoron.
The whole thing just comes crashing down around you. Can you tell me the book that had the biggest impact on your life or career?
The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
What a great book.
Amazing book. Oh. It just puts into words the struggles that I have faced and continue to face with my work and sitting down to do the work. So he calls it the resistance. So it's this force that prevents you from sitting down to do the work that you need to, the creative pursuit that you're on. And, you know, just reread it recently, and it helps me every time I'm facing a roadblock and I'm having difficulties actually getting to work.
And I love his, the sequel, Do the Work,
The War of Art and Do the Work. Yeah. Both of them are fantastic.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn in life?
Enjoy the process. We have a tendency to continue to look forward to the moment when we've made it, when we no longer have to worry about anything ever again.
Right.
As you find out, that moment never comes. And there's always new challenges and obstacles that will be had. And the more that you can enjoy the process, enjoy each day that you get to do the work that you love to do, even if you're just getting started out and you're not making any money, then I think like that's where contentment lies. That's where we find happiness, is in those moments.
Without question, because if you keep going after that, if you live in the future, you will never enjoy the present. And it's like that rat wheel. It's like that hamster wheel. Now, where can people find you, your work, and your personal home address? No, I'm joking. No.
Yes, of course. You can go to mattdiavella.com, mattdiavella.com. Mm-hmm. And like, if you social, it's all on there. You'll be able to find my YouTube channel and everything else from that website.
Dude, man, thank you again so much for taking the time. I know you're a very busy man these days, so I thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experience with the Tribe Brothers. So thanks again, man.
Thanks for having me, dude. This was a whole lot of fun.
Matt has definitely inspired me to let go of a lot of material things that I've been dragging around with me for not years, but decades. Things that really have not brought any true value to my life. And I just held on to because of the in just in case model of life, where one day I might need that cable. One day I might need that thing that I've been just lugging around with me forever. And I promise you, once you start decluttering your life becomes lighter. You have more energy to focus on things that you truly want to focus on. You start thinking about experiences and spending your money, time, and resources on experiences rather than just stuff. Now, if you want to go deeper into Matt's universe, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/003. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a positive review on whatever platform you are listening on. It really helps the show out a lot. And remember to trust the journey. It is there to teach you. I'll see you next time.